The gears of fate are turning, and people Kamui loves are about to get caught in the works. But what chance does anyone have to change their destiny if they can't even understand what their destiny is supposed to be?
We're Lucy and Robin, and we'll be your guides through Clamp's Wonderland. But first, a little check-in. How about that quarantine?
Yes, how about that quarantine?
We're really lucky because we live in a not super densely populated part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So while this is super devastating in every way, we are just a little sheltered from it.
Yeah.
If we lived in New York or any other densely populated city, from people that we know in Seattle and in San Francisco, I know how bad it is.
Yeah, well, I think it would be even rougher even if we lived just more downtown Portland than we do, but we both live, you know, a good, like, 20-minute bus ride outside of downtown, so we're in, like, neighborhoods and stuff, so we can easily, yeah, like, take walks and see people in a distance without, you know, any risk to them or us.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, quiet. It's weird because for me, I work from home. I live with two other people who also work from home.
Mm-hmm.
Our lives have not changed that much other than everything just being incredibly stressful and distressing and terrible all the time.
Yeah.
Other than that, it's fine. It's not fine. I mean, there's a lot of stress about, like, will anyone ever sell a book to a publisher again? Because is publishing going to continue to exist? Like, that, yeah, stuff is really stressful, but my book is still going, and I've had great conversations with my editors and people at my publisher, so, like, I'm really incredibly lucky. I feel really lucky. And your classes are still going on online, huh?
Yeah, it makes me very thankful for how much technology has improved and is available to most people in our society. Because, like, yeah, my classes are able to go off. I mean, it's different, but it's fairly similar. Like, they're all online, but most of them, well, they all have at least some sort of check-in time where we all meet, in, you know, in Zoom or something similar to Zoom. Program I'd never used until, like, 3 weeks ago, and now everyone's talking about it. And so we all meet and, like, have, you know, check-ins, or one of my classes actually does, like, a lecture live and then breaks people into, like, small chat groups where you go over, like, a worksheet together, and then he'll jump into the different, like, little video chat rooms and kind of go over things and make sure that you got, you know, all the answers right together. And in the other classes, there are video lectures and then, like, meeting times where we just come and can ask questions or clarification. She'll do, like, a practice problem or something for us. So it's actually going much better than the online classes that I've had in the past that were very, like, passive. Like, you just kind of had to read stuff and, you know, do discussion posts.
I hope this really improves online classes, because that would be such a wonderful quality of life improvement for so many people for whom online classes are the only way that they're going to, yeah, be able to be in college life. Like, I really hope that we end up having some actual, like, innovations that help disabled people and all kinds of folks could really benefit from us, I don't know, doing a little better.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think a lot of the this is kind of relying on the fact that there has been, like, 10 or so years of people doing somewhat consistent online classes. So we do have all this technology in place. And my school also is being good about providing laptops and stuff if you need them and don't have something. Because, you know, some people rely on the computer labs for all of their, or for mainly their, like, you know, essay type computer. Most people have phones that can do some amount of stuff, but you can't really write and print an essay from your phone.
I would certainly like to not have to try to do that.
God. But yeah, so I've been overall pretty impressed from what it seems like my school's doing, and the classes are going well. For me, it means I don't have to deal with all that, like, transportation to campus time, and I'm, you know, saving money by not eating food out, and, I mean, out on campus and stuff. Yeah, so it's weird. My roommate, I think we mentioned before, but works in, like, retirement homes, so her life is actually busier now.
Yeah, it's really intense. I mean, and she's really at risk, too.
Yeah, well, she's been making masks. Like, they're all wearing, like, cloth masks now. So she's been making herself masks, so she has a few different versions of them, so she doesn't have to wash one every night. because they want them washed. They want them clean every time they're being worn. So she's been doing that, and I think she's getting hazard pay at this point.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, so that's really nice, and it's lovely outside.
Yeah, it is beautiful. The cherry blossoms are blooming everywhere, and I need to go harvest some for some future strange drink or strange dessert that I'll make in honor of X. I think we're ready to talk about X, about volume 6.
Well, I think that's
six.
A good transition, actually. Like, because as I was reading this volume, I was very aware that we are in prime cherry blossom season, especially with it being cherry blossom season in Animal Crossing.
It's
very much like Seishno could be around any turn.
Yeah, we've definitely all been hanging out in Animal Crossing a lot. That has been our social life. And it's great. I went to a birthday party of a very dear friend.
In
Animal Crossing the other day. Like, that was really great. Like, thank you.
Yeah, I've seen people do that. We had, like, a trade party on my beach. I've seen people do catalog parties where you leave out good things and everyone takes them up and then puts it back down so that they can then order it from their catalog later.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
awesome.
So that sounds fun. We might have
to do that. We should definitely do that. That's a great idea. Now, the other thing, like, I don't know. Oh, man. Just, you're right. The cherry blossoms in Animal Crossing have definitely been giving me lots of Tokyo Babylon feelings, lots of X feelings.
Yeah. We didn't intentionally plan this volume to hit during April cherry blossom
season. I'm so glad it did, though.
It was so perfect.
Yeah. No, it's really great. All right, so this is volume 6.
Yes, which is the third volume in the second omnibus, if you're reading Viz's omnibus. And I know at least one of you out there is.
After our excursion through Wonderland, we're back to X. We actually are in 1994. I think that the chapters that were released in magazine format, that was still in 1993. But by the end of this volume, and like by the publication of the tankobon, we definitely are in 1994. In fact, we are in December 1994.
Oh yeah, I had a question that I thought you might know, because you seem to have more dates than I do. How long does it take them from magazine release to book release, like assuming the first chapter of a book?
I think it's 3 months.
3 months?
I think it is 3 months.
Mm.
It is not the same time every time. Volume 5 came out in October of 1993.
Mm.
So we are not on the same schedule of pages per week. This is partially because of the launch of what became one of their most important series, which happened in the summer of 1994, and we will not speak of it yet. But I can't find a lot of real info on this. They kind of went on hiatus for a large chunk of 1994. And some people speculate that it was like protesting their editor's expectations or video game addiction. But honestly, their official story is illness, and there is no reason not to believe that. It doesn't even matter if the other two things are partially true. Does not matter. They were so clearly overworked in a way, like, I mean, we've talked a lot about how many pages they're doing like per week in order to complete all the series that they were working on. Those are inhuman hours. Like, they were sleeping so far under the number of hours a human being needs to sleep, and that is 4 people working almost around the clock to complete their work. It doesn't matter if you're in your 20s, that's going to do permanent damage, and I think that they had some trouble in this period. But it doesn't come out on the page at all in this. Like, that may not be true. I think there is some depictions of anguish in this volume that look very real to me, and I wonder. I just said something, I'm like, ooh, maybe that's not true. Maybe that did come out in this volume. Maybe some of their, like, actual physical experience is here. We'll talk about that as we come to it. Anyway, again, this is volume 6. It is called Duet in the old Viz release, which is, I think, the first time, other than Prelude, which sounds fine, that I've been like, maybe this is a duet.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
I kind of like, there's a lot of duality in this volume.
There really
volume,
is.
So.
But there's a lot of duality in every volume.
Well, there is, but this one, we'll get to it, but it feels like things are coming to a head as far as that's concerned.
I think that theme is developing really well here. It features Kotori Mono on the cover with a flower crown and a garland and angel wings.
Hmm.
And I just wanted to say that we get a really big contrast. Like, Lucy, I know that you don't have the Japanese volumes just on hand, right?
Yeah, that is one of the things that I miss about us recording live is that I can't
show
stuff.
You.
Yeah.
But I can tell everybody about it. And what I can tell you is that the difference between just the print process, it's not even about quality. It's just the kind of printing, the kinds of inks, the kind of paper they're using. The Viz one looks fine, but if you see the original, the inks, the pink is so neon and vibrant, it's nuts. It looks nothing like the reproduction, which is so toned down. You would not have known that this was done in shocking bubblegum pink, and I love that color, and I love how beautiful the book turned out with that color. It's also searingly something from its period, because it was kind of a big deal that you could use inks like that.
So, is this the picture where she's sitting on, like, steps with, like, angel wings? Okay. Because I have it in the like, new Viz edition, and I wish we could compare, like, all three. But yeah, it doesn't look neon pink except little bits around the roses do.
Yeah.
Kind of the background pink is more of, like, a dusty rose, I guess. Yeah.
Yep. It is incredibly neon in this version, which is kind of cool. Just, like, an interesting thing to think about print process and how you just can't reproduce the same colors using every process. It's using different pigments, using different inks, using different paper. You just can't get the same stuff. So it's really interesting. The tarot card is the Lovers, featuring the same begarlanded Kotori and Kamui behind her turned away from the camera. And it has the Hebrew letter Zayin on it. That is an interesting choice of tarot card, as we will discuss.
It is. I love this image, too. Like, it's just so pretty.
Yeah, it's really neat. This particular volume does pick up right where 5 left off, which is Kamui's memories of his mother while he's actually kind of hanging out with Kotori. So this begins with just a little bit more of her talking, of him remembering her talking. And she really cements the use your power to protect the ones you love thing here. She explains that she failed to protect Saya, who was Kotori and Fuma's mom. And we also really get the impression, oh, she loved Saya. But she says that she was destined to die, so she was destined to fail. And we really get a lot of that fatalistic stuff from his mom multiple times. Like, she really believes in her role in destiny.
Yeah, she seemed more than maybe anyone except, like, Hinoto so far seems to, like, go hard on the destiny thing.
Yeah. This is also another moment where we're reminded that Kamui's cold, bitchy personality from the entire beginning really was just that he was trying to lassie go home Kotori and Fuma.
Yeah.
I really wanted to talk about the art here a little bit, too, because it's so shoujo, and in a way that is, like, incredibly complex and sophisticated. We have these panels that are layered on top of this more abstracted pastiche of images that kind of blend his memories of different events, and maybe even blend his memories with his mother's memories. So all of these panels of either the characters being happy or Saya's horrible dismemberment and death, like, just these beautiful, like, you know, rectangular vignettes over this sweeping imagery in a double page spread. It's really neat. It really gets out of the 9 grid, which is also a perfectly legitimate way to make comics, but this is so completely different from that in a lot of ways.
I'm just realizing we get a lot of, like, close-up of Kamui's big, beautiful eyes with distressed fingers and stuff in this volume.
We really do. I mean, I want to wait until we get to that particular page to just go on about it, but that's what I meant when I was like, ooh, I wonder if some of their own physical distress did come across here. Anyway, this moment, this reverie on his memories of his mother is interrupted by an old friend who is very, again, seasonally appropriate. Seishiro drags him into his weird, illusory Sakura space.
Yup. It was very exciting.
It was very exciting for us. Less exciting for them. I mean, exciting, not in a good way.
Different kind of exciting.
Yeah, Kotori got dragged in too, which is interesting.
Yeah, which, I mean, this marks for me the beginning of what seemed to be the theme of this episode of, like, everything seems to be coming together, like, all these things they've been dancing around. Right now, we have Kotori is actually in the mix of things and aware that stuff's happening. She's kind of dipped her toe in before, but this is one of those moments where we see Kamui's craziness directly, like, meshing with her reality, and it feels like a turning point.
Yeah, there's no way to pretend that there's, like, a normal world that he's not a part of and she is. They're now both in this violent, terrifying conflict. Seishiro fights him with what looks to me like these sharp drifts of Sakura. Kamui fights back using his sort of, like, psychic power stuff. Kamui kind of calls him out for some banter. So they have some banter that's, like, I wouldn't say a little flirty, but maybe a little bit. Like, Seishino is being his charming devil self with him.
Mm-hmm.
This turns into Seishino using more kind of Onojutsu-style magic against him, including his hawk-shaped Shikigami, unofficially and affectionately known as Nandoro, who we can finally get to see again. But Kamui holds his own against all this. Seishino escalates, and I love this drawing. I love the effect of the stacked deck of cards that he is fighting with, right? That are maybe Ohuda with curses or demonic invocations or something on them. And the cards are like swirl around him in a cool pattern, and then he sends them at Kamui and they turn into these blackbird Shikigami, and it's so cool.
Mm-hmm, yeah, this whole fight is really cool looking. I mean, even just starting with when he appears in like this shower of petals, like it's just so fucking good, Robin.
Yeah, no. And Kamui and Kotori are like on this shard of land, not a pillar of rock, but just like this chunk of rock suspended in darkness, because this is this strange illusory Sakura dimension. It's super terrifying, and I really love it. In the fray, two things are compromised. First, Seishiro's glasses, which shows his one messed up eye, and then in retaliation, poor Kotori actually gets more involved in this, and she plummets from the pillar that she was huddling with Kamui on. Kamui has been protecting her this whole time, and he protects her again. He manages to catch her before she, like, plummets to her. I don't know if it's actually her doom. Isn't this an illusion space? But it's real. We've heard before, like, they said that, oh, this is real enough to your brain that if you die in this, you will die in real life. So it's got a very much die in the game, die in real life thing.
Yeah, completely. Or die in the dream, die in real life.
But oh my goodness. So as Kamui is holding on to Kotori, trying to keep her from plummeting to her doom, Seishiro tells him, oh, he's so kind. Exactly what he used to say to Subaru.
And I died.
Yeah, and then she died, and I died.
I gotta say that this scene, specifically the revelation of his eye, and then the you're so kind, and so thus his whole interest, reads so stronger when I have read Tokyo Babylon. Because even before I knew who he was from, well, I mean, I guess the first time I read this, I didn't know who he was. But I've been aware of him before when reading X, especially rereading it and stuff. But having read Tokyo Babylon in completeness, then going more or less, not straight to this, but, you know, pretty quickly to this, it just... it hits so much harder. Like, this is a character I recognize and am fond of, and whose story I feel has so much more to learn about.
Yeah.
It just, it felt so much more impactful, like, just being like, oh, this is the station. Oh, he's at the same stage as we left him. Oh, God.
Yeah. He doesn't seem to have changed at all. He's saying the same lines, even.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just that, the fact that that line is a callback is also interesting, because it means he's kind of treating Kamui like Subaru. And he doesn't have any background with Kamui. He has no emotional connection, or lack of emotional connection, whatever it is. He has no connection to Kamui. But you can tell that he has connected him to Subaru, because he's using that line. It's such an obvious callback. And who knows what would have happened, because he's closing in for the kill. But Kamui is saved by Fuma, who, as we know, is able to, like, break into a Kekkai, so apparently he can break into this illusion, too. I think he protects Kamui in a very husbandly way. Like, it was drawn in a very protective...
Yeah, no, it's sexy. This volume is sexy, Robin. I'm gonna put that out there.
Volume 6 is the sexy volume, or the beginning of the sexy volume.
Or the first sexy volume, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, not always in a good way.
No, I mean, sometimes it's not... like, it's sexy, and then sometimes it's creepy.
Yeah, it definitely goes into a salty, but not past...
yeah.
Not past a salty.
Yeah.
Just light a saltiness. It's a little iffy, but it's also, like, legitimately has moments where you're just like, ooh, like this one, you're just like, oh dear. And I think that's maybe the first moment that cements that there might be a connection between the two that is more than just childhood friends in a very... not coded gay way. Like, you get a sense of like, oh, maybe that childhood friendsness is a little bit of a code here. Interesting. But that is not relevant to the moment, because what is more relevant to the moment here is that Fuma's mere presence seems to reverse Seishido's curses.
Yeah, it was almost like his big manly shoulders just propelled it away or whatever.
Yeah, thanks for setting me up for that, Lucy, because I need to point out that there is this panel where Protective Fuma's shoulders in particular and proportions in general are out of control. And I thought it probably looked better in the unflipped original art, but no, it's just really wild. It's just like totally out of control. I think it's interesting that Lucy's like, that is a sexy pose. And I'm just like, that shoulder looks like a shark fin.
Oh, no, it's more of a sexy moment.
Yeah, okay,
his
good.
His shoulder definitely looks like, it looks like he has wings, like, poking out, which I guess, because that sort of happens later, so maybe we could argue that it's...
I think he might be stargazing.
Yeah, well, I'm stargazing within the same volume. Mm. I don't think it's stargazing. But regardless, it does look like there's stuff protruding from his really broken shoulder there. Yeah. I don't know.
It's a little non-Euclidean. And I
do
mean,
you
want to
give me a stargazing thing for that? We've not actually had any.
I do. I am dinging. I would like to ding you for that. Thank you very much.
I will give myself that. Oh god, I have to figure out where I've been.
Well, you figure that out, and I'll keep talking about what's going on in this volume.
Do it.
Because Seishido is not up for the competition. So he just fucks off, taking his illusion space with him, which dumps our heroes out unceremoniously onto the floor. And Lucy has a note here.
I do, because, like, you say it was unceremoniously, and maybe I'm crazy, but, like, this face of his, I swear he's, like, it looks like he knows something. He doesn't look like he's been thwarted. He looks like he's like, oh, someone has entered the fray, or whatever.
Yeah, he's acting in general like this whole thing is some kind of game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would say that, like, he is definitely acting like this is a game or a dance or something that is not actually very important, which makes sense for him because he's not emotionally invested in this. This is just an interesting thing happening for him. It's something that has piqued his interest. So Fuma is interesting and he wants to, like, maybe step back and do some research and figure out what's going on before he makes a move. Man, Kamui has never been softer than in this scene. Where we get this, I think, honest reversal. Like I said, at the end of volume 5, there's this moment where Kamui is walking away from the Diet building and his conversation with Hinoto. And he's walking away, and then we see these flashbacks with his mom, and he gets to Kotori, and he softens there. But this is the softest we've ever seen him. He apologizes to Fuma directly for putting them in danger, even when he tried not to. And it's really sweet. And then it gets really weird, because Fuma responds to this by having what I described as a full-page psychosexual break, as he remembers his father's dying words, which, as you remember, are, "You are Kamui's ... while looming over him with his hands on his face. And at first it was just him, like, embracing Kamui in a very, like, oh no, it's okay, and then it got weird. He gets very handsy. He pulls him close, kind of flirt, fondling his face, and looking like a major creep.
Yeah, it's definitely a little rapey. Like, it's unsettling. Kamui does not look into it. It's not like... Because the moment before was very gentle and...
Like, the most vulnerable we've ever seen Kamui in front of other people. And then we have this moment where Fuma, who has been the most gallant gentleman the whole time, he looks like a different person. Lucy refers to him as Dark Fuma here, and I think that is generally how we should refer to him when he is in this mode.
Mm-hmm.
We get, like, at this double-page spread of this happening, with Kamui shown having the dual wings, the one feathered, one leathery, and Fuma grabbing the feathery one at the base, and it is very sexual and very creepy.
Yeah, I didn't actually notice until I saw your notes that he is grabbing his wing, and ugh.
Yeah. That would be really, really good if you knew they were both into it, but you know that's not quite what's going on. The weird thing about this sequence, though, is that Kamui maybe hasn't quite noticed something is weird. They're kind of sharing meaningful glances. There's, like, sexy eyes at each other. So there's this weird thing where, like, oh, Kamui, you are responding to this pretty okay? Like, he's not that creeped out by it. He's maybe a tiny bit confused.
Yeah, well, it goes straight from, like, I think I said, like, a legitimately tensionful, chemistry-full scene into Dark Fuma kind of taking over, and you can kind of see that Kamui's sort of thrown a little at first by that. I mean, as you would be.
Yeah, there's, like, a lot of interesting character acting with Conway's face and his poses here, we're not just reading into this, like, it is weird how there's this stuff that is, like, drawn on the page but not really stated about just how Uma rescued him really gallantly, and Conway's response to that was, like, so grateful because here he is being really soft and really vulnerable, and Fuma's being so physical with him was something he was totally okay with until it started to get just, like, a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kotori wakes up, and so they sort of snap out of it. She's really cute about the whole thing, but Kamui just wants to fuck off because her waking up is a reminder that he didn't protect her.
Mm-hmm.
And Fuma stops him, wanting to know what happened during the 6 years that they were parted. But we don't get to find out immediately because we pull back to see that Sodata and Nadashi were observing this whole thing. We also see that there is devastation in the neighborhood. Seishiro's illusion space is not the same as their Kekkai. Like, mm-hmm. They really made a big mess.
Yeah, and they, being Sodata and Arashi, mentioned that they were aware that shit was going down in Sakura space, but that there was nothing they could have done. Like, they were just kind of like, well, I'm glad that worked out okay, because we couldn't do anything.
Yeah, and interesting that they felt like they couldn't do anything, but Fuma could just waltz right in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very interesting.
So then we're going to switch it up real good. There's like a big old scene transition to a generic mad science lab. It's actually beautifully drawn, but it is still a very generic mad geneticist lab.
Yeah.
Where an older guy in an old guy kimono and a younger lady scientist are checking vitals on Nataku, who came back covered in blood, and they are realizing that it was someone else's blood. Which I wonder, does that mean that they hadn't sent Nataku specifically to kill?
Yeah, I don't think they did, because, like, so I saw this note and I looked back to volume 2 or whatever. It was something in the first 3 anyway. And that interaction between Nataku and Fumankotori's dad, he never says, Nataku never says anything very threatening directly. He just says that he's here for the sword. I think the old volumes used he, and so I'm all thrown off.
No, they really do.
And these volumes, by the way, use it so far.
That's not good.
But I mean, like, the scientists are saying
it. It's true. It makes sense for the scientists. I mean, considering what we're about to say next, it makes sense that the scientists may be very dehumanizing in their language.
Yeah, it's a little iffy, but I kind of get it. But yeah, Nataku is not being verbally threatening or really very physically threatening. They're just refusing to leave. And it's only after, I can't remember his name. Mr.
Mono-san. Yeah.
Once he says, like, I have to protect the sword. If you don't leave, I'm going to kill you. Like, he's the one who's making the actual, like, aggressions. So yeah, Nataku never said anything about, like, I'm here to kill you. Or even really anything like, you're between me and the sword or something. It was a very just a straightforward, this is an obstacle to the thing I need to do.
Yeah, and certainly that no one sent him specifically to do murders. That was just interesting. So we get this double page spread of Nataku floating in a sci-fi genetics lab tube. You know the ones. They're always in science fiction. Naked with some kind of numbering tattoos on their body and no obvious genitalia. The lady scientist says that she thinks of them as a doll. And then we get some real bad science explaining Nataku is human but completely artificial, a clone grown in an artificial womb. Quote unquote, a human grown without the necessity of a woman. Which is a lot to unpack after the egg baby saga we just discussed. And we will come back to that in the discussion portion, like towards the end of this. I'm going to really put a pin in that. Because I just want to talk a tiny, tiny bit about Nataku's, like, mythological counterpart, who is Neza from classical Chinese mythology, also known as the Third Lotus Prince. He was born as a flesh ball that his father split with a sword, and then he popped out of it, like, already a child and not a baby.
Hmm.
In this volume, the scientists refer to Nataku as a god from Chinese mythology without a soul, but I'm not really sure I don't know where they got that particular interpretation, because I really can't find it in anything that I've read. The character is interesting because, like, A, he has this very strange birth, but then at some point, like, boy, there's a lot of plot going on that I'm going to really, really abbreviate into the most important thing that he did, which was die, which is really, really sad. But an evil king wanted to eat children, so despite his parents trying to intervene, he sacrificed himself by carving up his own body for the king to eat.
Oh. Oh.
And then afterward kind of was apotheosized because he appeared to his mother in dreams and wanted a temple built in his honor, and that temple could heal people from illnesses and things. There is so much more drama after this, but we're going to sort of stop it there. He's a really important figure in folk religion to this day, often portrayed as kind of a rebellious teen in pop culture, but more like someone who rebels to do good rather than rebelling because they're just ornery or whatever.
Okay.
For our Nataku, who is not Neza, they say that he has no soul, no emotions, also has no gender or sex, and they kind of equate all of those things in this really weird thing. They say that all of this makes him like an angel, although I need to point out angels do have sex, like both gender and sex, in lots of Abrahamic tradition, hence the Nephilim.
Yeah.
So, okay. So that was weird.
Yeah, for me, it read as a little, like, almost too on the nose because of, like, because my volumes, they're calling people angels, and then this person's like, he's like an angel, and I'm like, I see.
Like one of the seven angels on the bad guy side, yeah.
So I'd be curious to see if they're actually using the word Tenshi there instead of whatever.
I think so.
Yeah, so, which is just interesting.
Yeah. So our mad scientists blame Nataku's deficiencies on not being born of woman. And boy, we're going to come back to that one, too. They say that Nataku is the product of 25 years of research at Tojo Pharmaceuticals. Congrats, Nataku. You are secretly siphoning one-third of a giant corporation's budget. I mean, might as well. And then they make it clear that they made Nataku to participate in this battle for the end of the world. So whether or not they send him to go do murdering, they know about the whole end of the world thing. And then they basically tell us the sword, which they also have, right, because Nataku retrieved it, is as alive as Nataku because it has the same elements as a human body. And no. No. We're carbon-based life forms. Most things have basically the same elements. Like, we're made of carbon. The sword is made of carbon. Like, that's not... No. That's not how that works. But we're going to just ignore that.
Yeah, I was also annoyed by that because they made this big deal about how Nataku was not born of a woman and this was special. And I was like, so is the sword more human than him just because the sword was born of a woman or whatever? Yeah, dude, like,
dude, they're literally saying that. Like, that is actually coming up. That is like, again, we were going to talk about that at the end of this, but that is legit. That is like, yes, that is legit a weird thing that is being brought up here, which is really interesting. Also, we find out that this lab is under Sunshine 60, which is one of the sealed places that we were told can't fall, or Tokyo and then the whole world will fall in a chain reaction, and that is how the apocalypse will happen.
Yes.
Sweet. So that's great. Meanwhile, Sarata and Arashi, who I think are the faces of meanwhile, they're like the representatives of meanwhile on planet Earth, are Sarata and Arashi.
Yeah.
Sarata's like flirting with Arashi, or flirts at her while he's on hold with the Sumedaki clan. And he gets to talk to Subaru's hot granny, who basically tells us what we already know, which is that Subaru's in Tokyo and he will suffer again having to fight Seishiro in this battle for the end of the world. And
crying.
Yeah, no, and like crying. So like, we're really excited because we're like, oh, anytime they even mention this character, we're really excited that we know he's going to be present. But I don't feel like that scene brought us that much closer. Like, it has to be that they're just teasing his appearance for tension for the audience. It has to be, because so far he has been brought up pretty frequently for not having done anything in the story yet.
Yeah,
and it feels a little redundant.
Yeah, it is, because it's basically the same conversation they've had before, except this time they actually got to calling him, which is good, or trying to call him. But I do think it's just to remind you, especially if you've not read Tokyo Babylon, that this is a character they've mentioned before and has, like, you know, ties to the spiritual world. Like, just kind of trying to, like, remind you that this person exists.
In all fairness, in a serialized format, it probably wouldn't feel super redundant because you're like, oh yes, I need to be reminded that this is still a thread that is going through. But when we're just reading it so many years after the fact, it's like, no, we've literally had this conversation. That is not new information. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And it feels like the third or fourth time we've had this conversation, too. But at least this one was like, oh no, he's there, and he's ready. Which is interesting.
Yeah.
So back to Kamui, he is just in anguish over his failure to keep Kotori and Fuma out of danger. I mean, what else is new? But What is new, actually, is that he's wearing Fuma's clothes, I think, because he's, like, swimming in them. Like, it looks, it actually is very vulnerable and sweet. He is sitting at a table in their living room, remembering times he had there with them as children. I think it's really effective. Lucy brought up a panel way earlier that I wanted to specifically discuss here. I think we'll probably, like, show an image of it, because I just think it's incredibly beautiful. I think it's one of the most beautiful... Yeah, I think it is one of the most beautiful clamp drawings that exists. It's an extreme close-up of Kamui with his face in his hands, and between his closed eyes and his tortured fingers, I think it really shows emotional anguish. It's really an incredible moment. And it's really where, like, any veil of him being bitter and cruel is just gone here. Like, we really see how bereft he is, how guilty he feels. He is realizing that he has failed every promise he made to his mother. Sword stolen, Mono-san dead, Kotori endangered. And then there's this amazing page where he remembers Fuma's weird moment where Fuma got, like, a little handsy with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it is framed in broken glass and Mono's dying words, which is, he is your, right? Kamui is your. Mm-hmm. So he's really shaken when real Fuma actually enters the room. And again, Fuma's asking, what happened 6 years ago? And then he reminds him that back when they were kids, and Kamui said he would be Kotori's bride, a right most adorable childhood moment ever, he made his own promise, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
If Kamui protects Kotori, I'll protect Kamui. If anyone makes you cry, I'll protect you from them. And then Kotori joins in on this pinky swear party, because they're definitely pinky swearing. And she says, well, she doesn't want to get mad, but if anyone makes Kamui cry, she'll have to get mad and she'll protect him too. And it's really sweet.
Yeah, it's so cute.
Yeah, no, I just like, it's interesting because I think that they really did sell you on these people having had this really important relationship as children. It's a little weird to go from 10-year-olds to 16-year-olds and feel like the last important thing that happened to any of them was when they were 10. But if you kind of just suspend disbelief, they really did sell you on how important they were to each other. Like, these moments, I think, are really, really sweet. And maybe, and not even, like, totally generic. Like, they're goofy. Like, it doesn't feel like just any three children could have had this relationship. There's something about these three people where you're like, yeah, no, I totally believe that as physically weak as Kotori is, that she's actually a little toughy. And I totally believe that it's sort of, like, small and scrappy as Kamui is, that he is willing to be both soft and strong. And also that, like, Fuma doesn't see any serious problem with any of this, right? That he's just like, okay, I guess Kamui can be, like, it doesn't sound totally right that Kamui could be Kotori's bride, but it's fine. He wants to do it. Works for me. Like, that makes sense. And that sweetness comes across again in, like, present time, where he pulls Kamui into this, like, sappy and not at all a salty embrace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, further cementing this as the sexy volume, rather.
Yeah, it's, like, really sweet. Done with sweet. Now we're ready for just a little dose of bitterness here. We do switch to seeing Subaru for the first time. He makes his debut. He cut his hair. He's dressed more to blend in. I mean, he's wearing a long white trench coat, but that's very 90s. I don't know. And he's smoking, which, oh my heart. The scene is just a couple pages. He sends some shikigami out, presumably to look for Seishiro, I would imagine. And then he blends back into the crowd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved this. I mean, it was so satisfying to actually see him. And the entrance is, it's just so pretty. Like, birds, you know, kind of lead you down to him. And then, you know, he sends them back again. And there are these feathers that, I know you're keeping, like, a separate feather count or whatnot. But it's just this, these pages are so lovely.
They really are. Like, they also give you a sense of what it would feel like to be in Tokyo at the time, because it's this crowd scene and you see the cityscape, and he's also, like, in a very specific area. Like, he's in kind of a pavilion in front of a building, and it's a place that feels like, oh, they took photos. Like, this is a real place somebody could really be.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, putting this character right here in modern Tokyo, and he's grown up and he's sad.
Mm-hmm.
He looks not like his childhood self at all. Like, he has grown up, and he has not grown up happy.
Yeah.
It's definitely this moment that we've been waiting for.
Yeah, I mean, really, we have, because I think they mentioned him as early as, like, the second volume or something.
Oh, yeah, maybe even in the first.
Yeah, maybe even in the first. And I think we saw bits of his face in one of the opening scenes or something. Like, and I mean, since at this point Tokyo Babylon has ended, oh, we've been waiting for this. But yeah, I'm going to go on a quick little rant still about this little transitional scene, I guess. And kind of, I guess, a defense of the, like, Arashi and Sodata conversation with, like, his grandmother and stuff, is that it kind of draws these really cool parallels. Because, like, we have them reminding you about how Subaru and Seishido have met before, and then we instantly have the scene that's all about this promise that the three little kids made, which kind of tainted that, not quite tainted, it added this unsettling tone to me, because
yeah,
Subaru and Seishido had, like, there was that promise that Seishido made Subaru when he was a kid that was a very different type of promise. So it made that scene feel, while still just as cute and sweet, it had this, like, ominous tone to it to me.
Which, fair, because Which, this fair. Is the most ominous manga, right? Like, there's just yeah. that sense of impending doom at all times. And I love that. Like, I think you're really right that mm-hmm. remembering another promise makes this promise feel even more doomed, really.
Yeah, and so I think that's kind of why they almost needed to remind you right in that scene, not only that they'd mentioned Subaru before, but if you've read Tokyo Babylon, they were adding, like, this layer of, remember how that ended? Remember how things went?
Yeah.
And then this, I went a little off the road on this, so we'll see.
No, but I love it. No, I love it.
So we've got all the birds in the little Subaru scene, and we know that Kotori's name, it means, like, small bird.
Yeah.
Which, if we didn't mention it, it does. And so we kind of transition straight from Subaru into her, and there's not, like, I don't know, it's just this big double spread of her, like, in a dream.
Yeah.
And it just felt like it, like, the birds had kind of taken us to her, and it just kind of made me realize that there are so many, like, personality-wise parallels between her and, like, young Subaru.
Yeah.
Presumably current Subaru, we don't know how he's changed, but as far as core personalities go, like, they're both very sweet. They're both very, like, they would sacrifice for other people, possibly to their own detriment. Like, we see Kotori do things that are maybe unsafe for her because she wants to save her friends. That was definitely a problem that Subaru had as well, or a virtue, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting also that, like, obviously, we had more character development with Subaru over, like, the course of so many volumes, but kind of in, like, first impression-wise, we are attached to him pretty quickly, or at least I was. I guess I can't speak for a completely, like, new reader. But Kotori comes off as a little annoying early on, and I don't know what the difference there is, if it's just that so Subaru was kind of juxtaposed against, like, his sister and Seishido. Like, there were all these kind of, like, stronger personalities around him that contrasted with him and made him more, not more interesting than he was, but made him kind of
distinct.
Yeah, distinct, and made you, like, notice his differences. Whereas in this, she hasn't had that kind of treatment. Like, Fuma's been kind of equally just nice and a little bland in like, the very beginning, as much as we saw. And then Kamui was, like, you know, wildly different, but they weren't really interacting that much. So I don't know if it's just they were presented to us differently, so we see her personality different, or if there's, like, you know, yeah. the gender thing going on.
So, apparently, while all this has been happening, not while Lucy has been discussing parallels and foils, but while all of the other things have been happening in the story, Kotori hasn't woken up since she was dumped out of the Sakura illusion space. And she's in this dream. She becomes aware, in this dark space full of swirling shards, the ones left over after a glass earth shatters in previous visions we've seen, and then seven robed figures rise out of the suddenly liquid floor. In front of some stock images of the Sephiroth slash Kabbalah stuff, one of them reveals himself to be Kamui. She's really excited to see him, but he bursts out in pain as angel wings come out of his back as she's running to embrace him. This would be fine. But then she looks down to see that they have a reflection where Kamui's wings are leathery instead of feathered. And then her angel-winged Kamui gets a creepy face and restrains her hands.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that angel Kamui is also kind of rapey.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Interesting. I wonder what this is telling us. Reflection Kamui looks sad when she asks him for help, And then everything starts to just disintegrate, and she sinks into the watery floor, drowning, until she's caught up by wires, crucified, and across from a mirror image of herself, which she has to watch get dismembered in front of her. Fun vision, guys!
Right?
And then she's falling towards the glass earth, horrified that she will be the reason it breaks and everyone dies. And she says, "If we have to crash, let me be the one to break." And we see her indeed shatter.
Which does feel like an old original Scooby-Doo thing to do. Sacrifice yourself for the world.
It really does. Where we had left off in that little conversation that Lucy was having about how we see these two characters, I think that it is kind of interesting that they are drawing parallels between the two of them. They're like little birds. They're very pure. They're very self-sacrificing. And I think that on the one hand, Kotoni just embodies everything that is a traditional feminine value and virtue in a way that is really grating, unlike so many women, because it's impossible to live up to the level of sweetness and goodness and purity that is projected for them to have to be. So when a boy lives up to that, it feels like, oh, this is his personality. He really is this way. When a girl is like that, it feels fake because it's what she's supposed to be. And you know, as a lady, you know inside that nobody really is completely like that and that it's kind of a performance, but it feels less performative from someone for whom it is not expected. I think what you were saying about just the way they're portrayed and, like, the context that they're in helps, too. I would say that she also hasn't really done that much. And had we seen her do more than try to save a little bird at some point, if she were fighting and doing all these strong, cool things, despite being really sweet and really soft, I think that it would be easier to see that as, like, a contradictory character with complexity. But she's just sickly and getting rescued all the time, and while that's really sympathetic, like, you can care about somebody who's like that, there's nothing inherently wrong or bad about needing help. I just think that she really did not come across as a strong and interesting character. And, like, some of it is just she's so stereotypically feminine. And some of it is she's not given that much to do, which is also very stereotypically feminine.
Well, true. I think it's also just that she doesn't have the benefit of being the main character. Whereas, like, we'd had more development in Subaru by the end of that first volume than we've had of her in any, like, and, you know, we're like six volumes in. Like, and that's just part of the position that they're playing in the stories, which is good. And, like, the parallels that they're kind of drawing here sort of remind you to, like, keep your eye on this character, you know? We don't know much about her, really. We've only... It's been, like, 2 days.
Yeah.
We've not had much time for them to, you know, even interact, really, so...
I'm pretty sure that by this point in character polls, she wasn't rating as low anymore, because, you know, like, she's done a few more things. And just their cute childhood, where, like, you're like, yeah, she's really soft and really feminine, but she's a tough customer in her own way, and that's really charming. Like, anytime you see them as kids, I'm just like, nah, she's kind of great. I would love to be friends with her. Like, totally fine.
I feel like Kid Kotori, we've seen more of her personality in the flashbacks than in, like, the current day.
Yeah.
Which is just, it just is interesting.
Absolutely. Back to X, though. She and Hinata both wake up at the same time. So it's like they shared this vision. And Hinata reminds us that this is the same dream Kotori always has, and she refers to it as a dream of the one future. In the other room, like, feet away from her, Fuma and Kamui are still having their embrace. Fuma's hurt that Kamui doesn't trust him to be able to protect him. But of course, we know that it's that Kamui has already failed to protect his dad, so he's terrified that he can't protect Fuma. And, I mean, that's been repeatedly driven home in this volume. All he wants was for the Monol family to be safe and happy, and he feels intensely guilty that he has already failed that.
Well, and he does finally gets to actually say it, instead of just, like, you know, internalizing it in his own thoughts or having us know it from context. Like, he actually gets to talk to Fuma, which I found very satisfying.
Well, he kind of gets to talk to Fuma.
Kamui does the things that he should do to make the conversation happen.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All I'm trying to say is he really talking to Fuma right now? Because this scene gets weird again. We're back to Fuma being weird. I think that it's sort of okay. Like, at first he says something, I think my version says, "Don't you see our fates overlap? I was born for your sake." Your translation is different, right, Lucy?
Yeah. It says, and this is once he's got, like, dark Fuma eyes.
Mm-hmm.
"You are the Kamui. My fate is twinned with yours. I was born for your sake." Which, the wording there just feels extra intentional.
And he kind of makes a move on him again. And I would not say that they're trying to get you to think that this is actually going to be, like, a sexual assault. It's more that he's, like, just drawing him in. Mm-hmm. It's like he feels like it's okay to touch him in a more intimate way. I think that we're, by being facetious and kind of joking about it, making it sound like it's more of an assault than it is. Like, it's more than just every once in a while, he gets this facial expression where what normally would just look like maybe kind of something slightly flirty or intimate looks really gross.
Mm-hmm.
There's this incredible panel where they're silhouetted against the light from the window behind them. And Kamui just keeps calling Fuma's name because he's panicking. This time, he noticed something was wrong. Fuma comes back to himself, and Kamui is very clear that Fuma has no memory of what he just did, and he realizes that that was not Fuma. But instead of getting to deal with this, we get the weirdest thing, the worst thing, that has happened in this volume so far.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, Tokiko, Kamui's aunt, she is back, and she looks terrible.
Yeah.
Lucy, you thought she was Yasha here.
You had to do a double take.
She has 80s mom bangs like Yasha.
Yeah, she has the 80s mom bangs, and like there's blood everywhere, and her hair is all messy. Like, I just had this moment where I was like, Yasha, what book is this? Like, I literally did a double take and was like, wait, how did I get to Yasha? And I was like, oh wait, no, okay. They're saying literally right there.
Yeah, definitely Tokiko, Kamui's aunt. She is not looking good, and Fuma wants to rush to get her help, but she says that, hey, she was always destined to die this way. And by this way, she means giving birth to the second sacred sword, which was apparently prophesized. Apparently the loss of the first one was also prophesized.
Hmm.
And we find out that Saya died in place of Toru, right? Toru was supposed to give birth. Toru is Kamui's mother. Was supposed to give birth to the sacred sword. Saya took on that destiny for her, which is, of course, the reverse of what is supposed to happen. The Magami clan are supposed to sacrifice themselves for somebody else, not have the opposite thing happen, which is interesting. So then Tokiko does some chanting in Hebrew, and her clothes are whipped away, and she starts to manifest a sacred sword for her body, and it looks like maybe it'll all be okay? Think about why there are two swords, she exposits at us, and gives us this last little statement, which is, seven dragons of heaven, seven stars in the sky, Ursa Major, which is the seven stars in the sky, has one star that always goes with another, a twin star. Which we kind of might have always assumed is Hokuto and Subaru, had we been really interested in speculating about what kind of astrological illusions they were using. But apparently it's not. She explodes into the sword in a horrifying but familiar gory mess.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and it is the end of this volume, by the
way. Yeah, it is how the volume ends. Well, sort of. I have to ding myself for early stargazing points because I mentioned the swords coming from Lady's thing and we didn't actually know that yet back in the Thaku part. So I'm getting two. It's okay. These are the first ones I've actually recorded. So if we've done it,
I love it.
Any of you out there, if you've noticed a time we've stargazed that we didn't comment on, please let us know.
I feel smug about this. Yeah. I feel less smug about how horrifying this book ended.
Yeah. I do have to say, like, I'm going to say this in a way, try very carefully not to stargaze while I say it. This book feels really heavy-handed to me on certain imagery, but I also have never read this without certain knowledge, because I saw the movie before anything else, and I'm not going to go into it because I don't even really remember the movie at this point, but it meant that I already had like sort of a vague idea of what was going on, although not much because I did not understand. But yeah, so I don't know if a person reading this volume for the first time would connect all the dots, but I was definitely like, yeah, we get it. I'm not going to talk about what we get yet. So if you're reading it for the first time, I would be interested to know if you feel like there's some obvious heavy-handed imagery here or what your thoughts are.
You mean things about duality, perhaps?
I mean, yeah. They're going hard on the duality here.
They really are. Man, before we get into, like, discussion zone, because there is a lot to unpack about that scene, that I've just described in a really, like, blasé and humorous way, but I need to admit that is because I find it very personally upsetting. So yeah. I'm just, like, using humor as a defense mechanism, the way my family does. But there is, of course, a little character chapter at the end of this. And this time it's actually Yuzuriha's story, which is great, because she didn't appear in this volume at all. And it's a really nice reminder that she exists.
Yeah, and it's very, very cute. And it's very quick. It's just like, I don't know, I've got my book here, maybe like 10 pages?
Yeah.
We learn by the end of it that it's a scene that occurred right before she popped in at the Daya building a few volumes ago.
Yes.
She gets ice cream and she's kind of talking to Inuki, her wolf dog thing. You can kind of see all the people around her looking at her like she's kind of crazy because apparently no one but her can see the dog. This guy kind of sort of creepily, but more fairly innocently hits on her. And she's kind of just like, can you see this dog? And he's like, what are you talking about? She's like, too bad. Only did someone who can see my dog. Peace.
I mean, that's a really good policy that I think we should all adopt.
Yeah. And she does also say she's on her way to a very important meeting about the end of the world at the Diet building. And you can see this guy being like,
she gives no fucks. I love her.
I love it. So she keeps walking and we kind of get this little memory of her when she was a kid, very upset because she was being called a liar by her friends because nobody else can see her dog. And her grandmother kind of just explaining that the dog shares her life. It's part of her power as one of the stars that will determine the fate of the world. And I couldn't really tell from this if her family could see the dog. I seem to remember there being something about their family having spirit dogs.
I don't know. We'll find out. She adorably asks if the other kids have soul dogs too, which, no.
Yeah.
They don't. And oh no, oh Yuzuriha, if only.
Yeah, it's just, it's very cute. So we jump back to the main scene where she's walking with Inuki and she's kind of explaining that she's excited to go to this meeting because hopefully these people will be able to see her dog. She's never met anyone who can do that. And as she's thinking this, she just walks by. Do we know his name yet?
Ooh, we don't.
No, I think he said his name. Kusanagi. He saved Kotori from the fire, and I think he, like, just posed at her and said who he was.
He's the big JoJo-sized guy in military fatigues.
Yeah, so he's just walking by at the time, and he just happens to be like, oh, nice dog! It's kind of unusual, but it's a good boy, or, you know, something to that effect. And Yuzuriha just, like, bursts into tears and hugs him. And it's just, like, the cutest thing ever. She says, you're the first person who can see him. And it's just so sweet. And I died. And yeah.
Yeah.
I'm kind of annoyed that this is an extra story. Because it seems like very important character development to me.
All of the extras are. None of them are things you could take away and still understand the story properly. It's just that they're vignettes that are being told outside of the timeline of the story because they couldn't find a good spot to fit them in, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think these characters have met in the rest of the series that we've seen. It's going to be interesting to see the first time they interact outside of the scene. I want to see how those, like, how much of that comes back or is reconnected because it seems kind of important. And she does kind of make a big deal about how, like, I suppose it's there in the early part too, but she says that, like, she could only really fall in love with someone who could see her dog, and she talks about how maybe once she meets all these people, she won't feel so lonely, which is just so sweet, especially because she's got this really, like, happy, upbeat personality, and then it's, I guess, almost nice to know that she's also lonely too, like, that she's not...
Yeah, she has depth.
Yeah.
Yeah, when we're talking about that depth, I think that is a little bit of what we were discussing with Kotori, that maybe it felt in early volumes like she was maybe missing a little bit of that depth, because you see only the surface sweetness and there is nothing underneath it, you know, or nothing underneath it that is surprising and or contrasting in any way. And again, I'm not sure that's entirely fair, and I think there is something to be said about how it's mostly a gendered thing because women are expected to behave that way, so we don't think it's very interesting when they do. And we maybe even have negative reactions to women behaving the way that they're stereotypically expected to behave. But I think with Yuzuriha, they really did avoid that. That she's really sweet, and she's really upbeat, and she's really perky, but she's also, like, you know that she has this little bit of loneliness underneath all of it. And that's really, like, really interesting.
Yeah, and it kind of drives home why she was, like, especially excited and perky at this meeting. Like, she was so excited specifically for meeting all these people. It meant she wasn't alone. She was actually with other people who had similar destiny, I guess, or powers to her. I do wonder if anyone in her family can see this. I'm still on this.
I think that she makes it clear that they can't. She says that he's the first person who's ever seen the dog. I think that excludes her family, dude.
Yeah, that must be pretty clear. I mean, because her grandma says Inuki is right beside you, but at no point does she say, oh, I can also see the dog because I too have spiritual powers.
Yeah.
So I think that we can only really assume that she is literally the only one who can see this dog. It's not just like a no one in the outside world, no one of not spiritual capabilities or whatever.
Yeah. Man, like, this episode is going to go a little over long, I think.
Yeah.
We're just really happy to talk to each other and to talk about this volume, but a lot happened in this volume.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to talk about. And I think that to get back to the whole, like, weirdness about the born from woman or not and swords being born from women, I think we're going to just put a pin in that. Mm. And that's going to come up again later. We're going to need to continue to talk about that weird thing. So, like, let's come back to that.
Yeah, we're not done dealing with sword ladies.
Yeah. Oh, God. If only we were. And it's also, like, I'm insanely uncomfortable about that conversation, too. Like, anytime you reduce people to biology and reproductive capacity, it is just so incredibly dehumanizing and horrifying.
There's a lot of yikes around that.
There's a lot of yikes. And it's really hard to talk about it in a way that isn't gendered in a way that I think is really regressive.
Mm.
But also, it's really interesting to have women telling a story with these elements, and I really want to bring up how this contrasts with Taito Monogatari, but we haven't had a good moment to talk about Taito Monogatari yet, which again is one of the big influences on this, so I think that that needs to just be a huge conversation for later, because I'm really interested in talking about the character parallels that we were discussing earlier, but also, man, there was something that you brought up there where you're like, oh yeah, Yuzuriha was excited to be with this group of people because these are like the first friends she's ever going to have that can really relate to her. And I was like, oh wow, that's kind of the same thing for Sodata.
Yeah.
He didn't have any vocation to become a monk. He's just been sequestered for a really long time in this very difficult, esoteric version of Buddhism that has like very strict upbringing. And like, oh wow, he is so happy to have met all these people, and he immediately imprints on everybody. Like, everyone's immediately his best friend, and also his sort of, like, immediate telling Arashi he's just gonna die for her, right? And not in a in a way that is not intended to be overly love-bombing. In a way that he's just like, this is just a matter of fact that, like, I'm gonna die for a lady, and it might as well be you, because you're one of the only ladies I'm probably gonna ever meet.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting thing. And how Kamui was so disinterested in meeting everybody. Well, of course he would be if he thinks that anytime he's around somebody, he's putting them in danger.
Yeah.
Right? Like, a really kind of interesting way to look at this story, like an angle from this is like, oh, each one of these people has a different relationship to the group. I mean, we definitely have the two adults. We had Karen and Aoki, the editor, and how for them, like, they have jobs and lives.
Yeah.
And this is just a thing that is sort of taking over their lives. But for the kids, this is a social life.
Yeah.
And Arashi takes it so seriously.
Well, she and Hinoto kind of have, like, this is the life they have sort of been preparing for. I mean, everybody kind of has that, but they seem to have a more of a, like, I don't know if mature is quite the word for it. They feel more, like, detached.
Yeah, like, they already live in the end of the world. They're not so much living in the real world that everyone else was.
Yeah. Whereas even, the like, Sodata being, you know, sequestered away, like, even though he knows he's been preparing for this, he's also been having, like, crazy kid hijinks. And so, like, and he still is just, you know, 16 or whatever. Yeah, it is interesting to think that for, yeah, the teenagers, that this is, like, a social gathering.
Yeah, they cannot help but that be a part of what is going on here for them. Mm-hmm. Like, that is just the lens through which this has to be seen.
I like that they're doing that. They're not just, like, magic teenagers. Like, it's actually, you know, impacting their life and their upbringing and stuff.
Yeah, I would definitely fight someone over the idea, like, these characters definitely do act like teenagers.
Yeah.
Like, the amount of moping is very teenager-y. The heightened emotional quality of everything I remember how well this resonated with me when I was a teenager. There are elements of this that I think now, as an adult, I view this as being, oh yes, this is so much what it is like to be a teenager, and these kids are actually acting like kids.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least like what kids think they would act like. Like it's acting like how kids feel on the inside. As a kid, I just felt it. I just actually identified with them and felt what they were feeling. As an adult, I don't as much. Like, it's definitely a little bit more abstracted for me now.
Yeah, well, I think that there is also, like, an element of having to grow up a little bit before your time, but also in a unique way, since they all... Like, Sodata apparently has known forever that he's gonna die for some lady. So when you see him being, like, more mature in times, that kind of makes sense. Like, they're not just normal teenagers that have been plucked. Like, in many ways they are, but they're also, they've had this big thing looming over them all their lives. They've got that perspective that kind of changes how you're going to think about things.
Yeah, none of them, other than Fuma and Kotori, ever thought that they were just normal people.
Mm-hmm.
None of these characters ever thought they were just normal people. Even Kamui always knew that he had a destiny and that there was something different about him.
Yeah.
It is only Fuma and Kotori who thought that they were normal. And even then, they grew up in a family who had a shrine that they took care of.
Mm-hmm.
They grew up in a family where, like, the dynamic had to do with taking care of a member who had heart problems,
mm-hmm.
Katori's health problems. As much as they are very normal, and those are very normal things,
mm-hmm.
even they maybe have cause to feel a little different from other people. And they were described that way in the first volume, that they're closer to each other than other people and stuff like that.
Yeah, and with like the loss of their mother in ways they were horrible, but they maybe, well, in Kotori's case, don't fully remember. Like, there's still a lot of...
Yeah, that can set you apart from other people. Like, those are things that can make you feel less like you can relate to everyone around you. Those are just, like, not what we consider to be a typical experience, even if, though, on some level, of course, they are.
Yeah.
We all deal with loss. Like, that's... No one's life is untouched by loss.
I do think that's kind of why this volume felt especially like things were really getting going. Like I was saying earlier, it feels like we've crossed another threshold. Because like now Fuma and Kotori are in the thick of things. This isn't going to be like, oh, we're going to hand wave it away so that the normal friends don't know what's going on. Like, no, they don't know what's going on, but they are now more clearly a part of it than they were ever before. Like, it feels like we're not in that same part of the story anymore. We are now in a different part.
And even if unconsciously, Fuma did something overtly magical by mm-hmm. being able to reverse those curses, and now he's having these weird spells where he's kind of becoming a different person.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we saw Kotori's dream space, and it was much more of a vision this time. It was much more clear that she is having some kind of supernatural event herself. So maybe they aren't so normal.
Yeah.
Maybe the two of them are not only involved in the plot just because of Kamui's presence, but maybe they have their own roles to play and we're going to have those roles no matter what.
Yeah.
Which we don't know precisely whether that's the case, but there's inklings that maybe that could be.
Yeah, there is like this sense that even though Kamui is holding all this guilt for getting them involved, that maybe that actually had nothing to do with him and they're more involved in this than any of us realize yet.
Yeah, and it could even be that they just have their own agency, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they're allowed to make the decision that they want to be involved in this, whether he wants them involved or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of those are interesting things that are being brought up.
Yeah.
Also, our boys are back.
I know, I'm so happy, Robin. I'm going to talk about them more later, because we haven't even gotten to most of it, but I'm just very excited that they're back. And it really is adding something to me for the experience of rereading this, is having actually, like, fully had Tokyo Babylon before going into this. And, yeah, it's so delightful.
Yeah, on some level, this whole thing, which is this huge, sweeping epic, is just a sequel to Tokyo Babylon.
Yeah.
And if you view it just as that, it's still pretty amazing. I think it's a little unfair, because all of the main characters are really, really richly... you know, richly treated.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I thought it was interesting that this volume has the lover's card, but the sexual tension was mostly between Fuma and Kamui,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even a little bit between Seishido and Kamui, who I think Seishido is treating a bit like a stand-in for Subaru.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was weird and interesting to me, that on some level you're just like, okay, you know, there's this sort of surface level, there has to be romantic tension between Kotori and Kamui. And she definitely loves him in a way that makes her blushy around him. Mm-hmm. And he sort of acts that way around her, too, especially towards the end of Volume 5. We got all those cute scenes where they were tripping all over each other.
Yeah.
It was very adorable. But there's something really interesting about how in this volume, all of a sudden, the sexual tension is 100% Fuma and Kamui.
Yeah, it really ramped up. Like, it wasn't that there were never, like, you know, anything between them before, but it very much had that feeling of, like, oh yes, childhood friends, which, you know, is a thing in and of itself.
Yeah, that is sometimes kind of coding.
Yeah.
For having had adorable kid romantic feelings for each other, but...
yeah. But it feels like in this volume, it took a turn, and it wasn't just a turn with what we're calling dark Fuma. Like, it wasn't just that, because while that does happen, there are scenes that happen when he's being normal Fuma that Kamui doesn't feel, like, confused by. Or, I mean, he's confused by him being possessed, but he's not confused by, like, the intimacy. It doesn't even seem, like, upset by it.
No, he seems really responsive and, like, receptive to the intimacy, actually. And some of it is that he's ready for this. Like, he is so vulnerable, and Fuma is meeting that vulnerability with his own vulnerability, which we have also not seen so far. Fuma has been so strong through his father's death, through Kamui's return and weird behavior, through Kotori's spells. He has been incredibly stoic. And we got this little moment of him being, like, really committed to him. Like, he is ready to commit to this person again. For him, those 6 years didn't matter. Like, they didn't happen other than as a mystery he wants to have solved in order to help them have their childhood intimacy back.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's
interesting.
It is. And I think they're very much, like, in some way right now they're playing into kind of, like, almost like yaoi tropes where you've got, like, the big, strong, more aggressive guy and the younger, or not necessarily younger, usually younger, but smaller guy who's kind of like, no, we mustn't. And a lot of that's going on, and some of it is definitely kind of sexy in this, but some of it is also dark Fuma taking over. So there's a lot of interesting, like, you don't quite know how to feel about this. Or at least I didn't. I was like, oh, it's cute, but also, oh god, no, it's not.
Yeah. That tension between the, like, oh no, they really have an intimacy, they really do have feelings for each other, and those feelings do seem to have some kind of weird romantic something, like, even if not completely romantic, like, there is something that is more intimate about their friendship than we previously understood. The tension between that and Fuma is getting dark and cold, but also more aggressively physical.
Mm-hmm.
That is really weird. And that definitely, and I agree, that really plays into some of, like, I don't know, the more not great BL tropes that are things that exist for porn's sake less than for literature's sake.
Yeah.
But this doesn't feel like that at all. Like, this feels like it's being handled in a really literary way where, like, they're literally trying to contrast this really gentle character with this really dark aspect. And they're only ever tantalizing and hinting with this. It's not, like, I mean, I don't think it's stargazing to say that this does not turn into a sexual assault ever.
Mm-hmm.
Clamp kind of don't do that. Of all the things you can accuse them of, they tend to not go there at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that the moments that get close, some of the moments in Tokyo Babylon, as I said, I'm sure I mentioned that when Subaru is asleep, just passed out from being too sad in Seishiro's apartment, and Seishiro pulls back his glove a little bit, like, that felt both intensely and maybe very uncomfortably sexual.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, yeah, that was pulling back his glove. Like, that kind of moment feels really intensely intimate and violating in a Clamp work. You don't expect it to do anything more overt than that, which I think I really respect that in them, because I think that keeps it in a space where, like, teens especially can understand what that moment is meaning without also having to bring up all of these assaults and things which aren't sexy and aren't fun. And when they are brought up in Tokyo Babylon, it's never in the relationship part. It's always in the sad ghost story part. And I think that's really responsible of them.
Yeah, and I mean, I really, going into X this time and seeing these elements, I do kind of trust them more, having recently read Tokyo Babylon, like, I know that they're going to handle it well. Which, I mean, is not to say that, like, you know, there's there's definitely a lot to be said for, like, BL and, like, fanfiction and romance in general, where you play around with this type of tension and it's not necessarily a bad thing. But I like that they're handling it in a way that doesn't, I guess, exclude other people who aren't going to be into that. Like, they're making it a part of the story, but not the point of the story.
I really appreciate that in anything. Like, I want queer content in everything, because that's just the lens through which I have to see the world. I don't necessarily want things to just use that element to advertise themselves, right? That is not a fetish for me. That's just my life. And so there's that element of, like, oh, if a story about the end of the world also has queer characters, I'm really excited. As opposed to something that's just romances, may not get me as interested unless I understand something else that's going to be intriguing about it.
Yeah, like, it makes it feel like it is queer, not just exploitative, or
yeah,
not aimed at queer people, but meant to be sexy for, like, straight people or something. Like, it yeah. feels like it's,
as I said, more fetishizing.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And I will definitely say that, like, this is very much a your mileage may vary yeah. moment. Because there are plenty of people for whom Clamp stuff does not work at all, but there's also a lot of people I know for whom this was an important early queer awakening thing for them. Mm-hmm. And obviously for anyone who is not queer, like, I totally imagine you can understand and appreciate all the complexity of all of this. Oh, it just yeah. doesn't mean exactly the same as for somebody who is, like, starved for this content because they are looking to see themselves or whatever. Like, it doesn't mean exactly the same thing, but it's not like you're not totally, like, there and getting it.
I do want to say that I think that there's, it's, I mean, it's basically what you just said, but, like, it's totally legitimate, even if you're not queer, to find, like, yaoi and queer stuff, you know, satisfying or sexy or even just, like, safe for you.
No one is allowed to go into your head and tell you what you can have in there. Like,
yeah.
It's fine. You just want to be responsible about how you behave with other people
mm-hmm.
because you don't want to hurt other human beings. But if you had to go in there and, like, edit every thought you'd ever had, you don't want to feel like you have to do that either. You know, like, no one is being exploited by you having a sexual fantasy. Like, no one cares.
Yeah.
It's your business. It's very private.
Yeah, but
it just matters what you put out there and, like, how you communicate with people about it.
But for this, it does mean that someone who is queer, am able to stomach it a lot better without having to kind of, like, come at it from a perspective that doesn't quite fit me, you know?
Yeah, no, I can definitely, there's something really interesting to me about the weird relationship. And, like, on the one hand, it's weird that he seems to have, like, romantic feelings about a pair of siblings. Like, that's awkward for me, because I've got a lot of siblings and it's weird. On the other hand, it's not no incest baiting at all.
Yeah.
So it seems much more like just trying to be clear that relationships can be complicated and complex, which I think is, like, fair. It's better for people to find ways to reconcile themselves with, again, all of the things in your head and your heart, and find a way to be safe about those things rather than to just turn everything into something sensational and terrifying. Like, there's something interesting about how this is going. They're definitely not treating the three of them having this, again, not overtly romantic relationship, but there's definitely tension there.
Mm-hmm.
They're not treating it like a tragedy in progress. The tragedy has nothing to do with these people's relationships with each other.
Yeah.
The tragedy is that their relationships are going to compromise them, but not compromise them because there's something inherently sinful about the relationships. And of course, they did that in Rig Veda. They did that in a lot of other things. They're very good about that. And that definitely, for me, helps me feel comfortable with their queer material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Agreed.
Man, I think that wraps up everything we can really talk about for now. Like, there's so many things that got brought up here, but, like, we really are just gonna keep coming back to those themes as they develop. Mm-hmm. And at this point, this episode is super long.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, everybody.
I think it's a good place to leave it. So, you can follow us on Twitter at ClampCastPod, on Facebook at Clampcast in Wonderland. And we now have a Tumblr, which is Clampcast in Wonderland, as you might imagine.
I love that we have a Tumblr when Tumblr doesn't matter anymore.
I know.
But it's really fun to show artwork, guys.
Yeah,
so
I really just wanted a spot where we could just, yeah, reblog Pretty X and other Clamp work pictures. My brain's just an X right now. But yeah, we're on there. And we have our Patreon, Clampcast in Wonderland, obviously. And we already have a few backers, and I just kind of want to give
you
a
everybody.
Shout out.
I can't
out.
Believe it.
Yeah, it's very, very sweet of you. We really appreciate it. And extra impressive is that most of them are $5 backers, not just the the base $1. And I mean, we really appreciate it. We're going to start having content soon up there.
Yes, very soon, actually.
Yeah, we've already got a few things kind of in production. And yeah, we just really appreciate it. And it's very exciting.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and also thank you for coming with us on our journey through Clamp's Wonderland.
Until next time, remember that everything will be all right.
And try not to lose an eye. I almost did, by the way.
Yeah.
I totally had a weird allergic reaction that's made my left eye swell shut, like, at the beginning of the week. And I wanted to look like a Clamp character, but instead I just looked like someone in Animal Crossing who'd been stung by a wasp.
Yeah.
My eye is fine now, but I got to, for just a moment, I felt just a little bit like a Clamp character.
Well, have a good one.
Yes.